Hey, y'all, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Oh, I need to hit go on that thing, don't I, there? Oh, first I need to copy, then go. I'm publishing a blog entry, that's right. That's scotthorton.org. I'm updating my status at liberty.me. And the blog will push to Twitter automatically, so that's nice. Yeah, so I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which means I'm against all of it. I was against Bill Clinton doing things, and then I was against, well, I was against George Bush doing things, mostly. Well, I was a stupid kid then. But I certainly opposed Bill Clinton's every breath, in fact, certainly every activity beyond that. And same for Bush Jr. and same for Obama. That's part of the beauty of being a libertarian. I never was a liberal or a conservative ever in my life, so I don't come with any of that horrible ideological baggage. And I don't have a hard time hating all sides at all. There's no cognitive dissonance for me whatsoever. You know, I just read a thing. It had, it was David Swanson, and it had a couple of bad things in it that disqualified it to run at antiwar.com, but it was still interesting to read, and it was about what happened to the anti-war movement. And it's all there in the math. They did the study. It's a comprehensive study. And what happened was Obama got elected. And not only, and this is a real in-depth study. You ought to look at this thing. A real in-depth study that they did here, wrote a whole book on it. And it wasn't just that the Democratic Party and MoveOn.org and all of the biggest, you know, Soros-funded liberal astroturf out there, that they quit. I mean, even the Answer Coalition that sponsored almost all the rallies, they just disbanded, basically, when Obama came to power. But it wasn't just them. It was all the rank and file, too. It was, they did this study where the more likely you are to call yourself a Democrat, the more likely you are to have found other interests than foreign policy as soon as it even started becoming clear that Obama was running. You know, obviously, they used the war issue on his behalf against Hillary in the primaries and then again against Bush, I mean, against McCain in the general election. But they hardly even had to, and then they promptly forgot about it immediately. And not just, again, not just the liberal and Democratic Party establishment, but liberal and Democratic voters. If Obama wants to double, triple, quadruple the Afghan war, they don't even know to care. Because they decided they didn't want to know. And that's mostly how it's been. And that's what happened to the anti-war movement. They never really meant it in the first place. They were just the Democrats. So, anyway, I don't have that problem. I'm against all of it. All of it. So, that's the show. To that end, I interview liberals and conservatives and whoever else, whatever other experts and lawyers and whatever, whoever I can, to try to discredit what it is they're doing, which is always very easy because what they're doing is always wrong, and the excuses that they use to get away with it are always lies. So I pretty much just have to get up in the morning and show up, and their job pretty much does itself, you know. Phil Giraldi is going to be on the show today to talk about the cost of the warfare state. He's got a great article about that for uns.com. And then, you know, I think I'll probably ask him some Iraq, Syria type stuff, too. Depending on how much time we got left. It's an in-depth article all about some statistics and some dollar figures. And then James Carden is going to be on. He's from the National Interest. You know, I think I had a lengthier bio of him somewhere at some point. I think he used to be a government guy or something. Yeah, maybe Google that up in the during the break. But anyway, he writes for the National Interest and, like Phil, for the American Conservative magazine. And he's got one on the Ukraine and why not to arm them. Good reasons. You know, there's an article by Stephen Walt, which I can't run at antiwar.com, also because, like that David Swanson piece I was saying, has some fatal flaws in it. Mostly, it's at foreignpolicy.com, and they have the most ridiculous paywall. And even their thing that's not a paywall, that you can actually just click X and clear it out of the way, it looks so much like a paywall that people just click away immediately. I mean, I don't know what they're doing over there. They just completely sabotage their site. But anyway, Stephen Walt had a good one. So I'll try to bring up some of the ideas from Stephen Walt's piece with James Carden. But I'll also recommend it, too. You can go, they give you the first, you know, 5 or 10 articles free, like at the New York Times there. And even registering is free. You just got to register. But nobody wants to register. Why do you want to register? But anyway, it's still toward the beginning of the month. So, and I'm sure you all haven't been reading Foreign Policy because of their stupid paywall thing. So you ought to be able to go and pull the Walt article right up. Interesting stuff there. Stephen Walt. I like that guy. And, you know, compared to a libertarian, he's a warmonger. But compared to the neocons, he's a libertarian, if you know what I mean. So, anyway, that's Stephen Walt at foreignpolicy.com. All right. Couple of articles to recommend while I'm bringing that up. March 6th, I'm giving a talk at the Liberty Forum. And, you know, I keep thinking it was about the terror, it should be about the terror war, but now I'm thinking maybe it should be more about the empire in general, so I can incorporate, you know, Africa and Europe and the pivot and the military-industrial complex and whatever. That's a lot to talk about in 40 minutes, though. I don't know, man. I guess if I wrapped it up nice and well. March 6th. It's a 3-day thing. The 5th, the 6th, and the 7th in, I don't know what city. Somewhere in New Hampshire. And I'm going to find out more details, but anyway, you can look it up online. I believe it's NH Liberty Forum. NHLibertyForum.com. And I'll be speaking there. Looks like a pretty solid event, man. I don't usually go to things like this, but thanks to the people for inviting me. I'll go and try to give a talk about something. If you live up in the Northeast or New England or whatever the hell you call it. I mean, if you're from South Carolina, you're a Yankee to me. But anyway, if you're from anywhere near there, then hey, see you there. Cool. All right. Oh, yeah. What time is it? Oh, good. Yeah, just enough time to squeeze in an extra little show of support for my sponsors who do so much to support me and this show and to keep this project going for you. Seems like my thing I ought to keep doing, right? Interviewing the people about the things they write. All right, so that's Mike Swanson, author of The War State. Get it at Amazon.com. And also WallStreetWindow.com. Sign up for his investment advice newsletter. It's worth it, believe me. He just shows you, here's what I'm doing and why. And I think you'll come to see real quick how valuable it is. That's Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. And then, of course, there's Phil Giraldi's group, our upcoming guest. The Council for the National Interest is his group, which is basically an anti-Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., which means pro-America. And then there's, of course, the Future Freedom Foundation and LibertyStickers.com. There's Darren's Coffee and Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. They've been very generous. Good guys over there at Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. If you want to buy some precious metals on the recommendation of Mike Swanson, you probably head right over there. It's rrbi.com, like run batted in. RRBI. Oh, .co. That's what it is, .co. Sorry. Darren's Coffee. Great coffee. Free shipping. So he's taking a loss to get you the coffee just to help support this show, guys. Basically is what's going on there. Darren'sCoffee.com. And it's great. It's great. And I'm a Folgers guy, so I'm just spoiled rotten now. I don't know if I'm going to ever go back. But that's Darren'sCoffee.com. And then, well, I'm out of time. There's more, but back on the other side of this break. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. How do I sound? Oh, you know what I could do? I could look at the recording with my eyeballs, these waveforms, and see. Yeah, it does look like I'm skipping out a little bit there. Check. Coming up next, a double shot of Aerosmith. We're going to play Sweet Emotion twice in a row because we're trying to drive up the suicide rate. All right, now, so does that sound all right? That's good. All right, they say it's better now. God, I hate Aerosmith so bad. Don't you? Don't you hate turning on the FM radio? Sweet Emotion again? Really? Why do you think I want to hear this? Why are you trying to make me hear it? I don't want to. It sucks. I've heard it a million times, no matter how bad I hate it, because I can't help it, because you keep playing it. Leave me alone. Don't you hate Aerosmith? Don't you hate Two for Tuesday? Jesus Christ. Sorry. All right. But it sounds okay now, though. Oh, sounds bad again. Well, it ain't the mic.
I don't know.
Well, I got an idea here. I'm going to put on the Beastie Boys for you. And then we're going to see whether the music is cutting out. See if we can isolate... See if we can isolate this problem. All right. So, let's see here. Turn that up. Oh, for crying out loud. Alright, so chat room guys, tell me, is the Beasties cutting out too, or is just my mic is cutting out? You know, I was on the phone slash microphone with Michael W. Dean this morning, testing out the Fiend phone, and I was talking about how much I loved my mic, and I guess I just jinxed it. Is my mic jinxed? What if I plug it back in. Good and tight. All right, they say the music sounds fine. I guess it's just my mic that's broke. I'm going to have to call this show off if we don't fix this by the bottom of the hour, guys. Because what the hell am I going to do? I can't interview people with a mic going out. I wonder if it's the board. I wonder if it's the M-Audio sound card has finally had it. I wonder if it's the compressor. Might be the compressor. See, that's the problem with having so many things in the chain, and a problem like that, you gotta try to isolate it, and it doesn't always take only a short amount of hours. Yeah, sometimes it takes a long time. That's what I mean. Sounds good now, they say. All right, well, chat room guys, I'm gonna try to talk for a minute. You let me know what happens. First of all, I guess I want to go back to talking about the situation with the U.S. and Iran and Israel, where, for whatever reason, at least on the nuclear issue, Obama is redirecting the policy back toward the Shiites. And I don't know if he's even thinking about this in terms of the civil war that Bush started over there or what, but he wants to put at least the nuclear issue to bed, which is de facto putting the Cold War with Iran to bed. It's a major first step. I know it's still a long, hard road. Major first step toward possibly having an end to the Cold War with Iran and a reopening of relationship there. And that's why the war party hates it so much, because they would rather have a war and a regime change. And they don't care how much money it costs or how many Americans die in the thing. that's the policy of the government of Israel, and therefore of those the Israel lobby controls in Washington, D.C. And that's pretty much the only difference. You can see who has American interests at heart at all and who has partisan interests and mostly foreign interests at heart. And, you know, I mean, Netanyahu, for example, he's just lying. As I quoted you that statement yesterday where he implies very clearly that the deal that Obama is working on is a deal to give them nuclear weapons. We will do everything we can to block this dangerous agreement against Iran's arming itself with nuclear weapons, as though that's the agreement that they're working on. It's just a damn lie. That's all he can do. That's the best he can come up with, is to just try to and then what? You just fill in the gap yourself. Well, he must be making sense and know what he's talking about because I like him or something, and then that's it. But meanwhile, Obama's certainly digging in his heels on this. He is the emperor of the planet Earth, after all. And so, come on, man. You're out of bounds, Netanyahu. And you know, it's not just like when George Bush wanted a war real bad and the Israelis helped lie us into it. This is a case where the American president wants, which was horrible enough. Read Bamford, read Dreyfus, read Borger about that. But Katowski. But when it comes to this one, where the president's trying to make a de facto peace deal, a pretty much peace deal with a country, and we have the Israelis interfering with that, the prime minister publicly declaring that we will do everything, we will take any action to foil this bad and dangerous agreement. Man, that's a pretty big deal. And it's kind of amazing to me that he's doing this, but I guess it makes good politics for the short term in his election, and he's counting on a Republican to win next time, or Hillary Clinton to be the president in just another few years, and so screw it. But I don't think he could stop the deal now. I'd be willing to bet that all those sidewalk talks that got all the notice in Iran between Zarif and Kerry, I bet you that right there they're saying, okay, so we have our deal. Next time we meet, you say this and I'll say this, and then we'll both sign the thing at the bottom and it'll be done and we're going to do it. They want to do it. The will is there. I think, and that can change, but it seems to me like the president and the secretary of state must have had just them heart-to-heart talk. We're like, hey, man, all posturing aside and everything, we really want to do this effing deal, right? Okay, let's really do it. I just believe that. It just seems like that to me. And they do say horrible and hawkish things sometimes and really piss me off, and they're not trying nearly as hard as I would like, or they would have had this deal a year ago. But you know what? The Israeli position here, I think that Netanyahu has taken his entire country way out on a limb, and I'm happy for it. I think the deal's going to happen anyway over Netanyahu's proverbial dead body, and it's just going to make him look like even more of a chump than he already looks like. And he's being completely savage from the right and left in Israel for jeopardizing the relationship with America. Never even mind the Iran thing, whatever with the Iran thing. You're pissing off not just, you know, some American people, but people in the American political establishment really resent this and are going to continue to. And what are you doing?
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks, chat room guys, for helping me out with the audio problems there. I think the consensus is that sounds okay now. Let me know if there are any more problems.
All right, now, on to our first guest on the show today. It's our friend Phil Giraldi. Hey, Phil, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Good to have you back on the show, and good to reach you at UNS.com, as always. Here, trillions for defense. America's soldiers have become too expensive to use. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that, you know, ever since the incident of 9/11, Congress has been showering all kinds of pay and benefits on American soldiers. They've become the hero of the moment. And the fact is that if you look at it objectively, currently they get paid way too much and their benefits are crazy. And these are expenses that are inevitably going to escalate over the next 20 years as we pay down on the expenses of these wars. So I'm basically saying that, you know, Americans should recognize that we have too many soldiers and they're paid too much.
Yeah. All right, well, now, so I like to think of myself as young, but I'm really not. My dad was pointing out how gray my beard is getting lately. So I sometimes, at times like that, have cause to remember that a lot of people listening are quite a bit younger than me, even. And I surely don't remember Vietnam, although I grew up surrounded by people who remembered it very well. So I kind of have a flavor for that era a little bit, not in a hippie way, but certainly in a resentment of what the government had done during that time kind of a way. But there are certainly people listening right now who don't have the slightest connection. I mean, you might as well be talking about the days of Theodore Roosevelt or something if you're talking about 1968. So can you take us back, Phil, and tell us a little bit about how it was and what exactly has changed in the way the Army operates and deals with things like, for example, pay, but more than that, when it comes to the enlisted men in the Army?
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, the Vietnam Army was largely an army of draftees, so it was completely different than what we have now. Essentially, you know, we had at one point almost 600,000 soldiers in Vietnam alone, and you can only do that if soldiers are cheap. And when I joined the Army, or was drafted into the Army, actually, in 1968 out of college, as a private, I was making $70 a month, is my recollection. And by the time I left as a sergeant 3 years later, I was making a little over $300. So we weren't paid very much. And the idea was that, of course, most of us were temporary, and that once we got out, we went back to our normal lives. Now, today's Army is completely different. It's a professional Army, and it's only driven by money and benefits. You can argue that at least some of the soldiers are driven by patriotism and desire to do this and desire to do that. But the real reason is a lot of soldiers are there because there are not a lot of good jobs in many parts of the United States. And you go into the military, and it's very easy to get a job where you're in the military, where you're not in any danger, and you're never going to be in any danger. And after 20 years, you come out, say you go in when you're 18 out of high school, you're 38 years old, you're going to get a really nice pension for the rest of your life, full medical benefits very cheap for the rest of your life, and a lot of other things, and you start your second career, and a lot of them will work for a defense contractor or something. So it's a whole different world now, and the world is this is a professional Army, and the American people who probably grew up on John Wayne movies and this kind of thing have to kind of readjust their thinking as to what we've got here. Mm-hmm. It's a different animal. It's a different thing, and it may not be exactly what we want.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me more about these pensions, and if you could compare to how that would work in the private market if somebody worked for whatever.
Well, yeah, it's pensions are probably and health care are probably the biggest issues. If you go into the Army, or any, I'm saying Army, but I mean Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard. If you go in the military, after 20 years, you get basically a pension that is half of what your final earnings on active duty are. So if you're making, say, $70,000, you're going to get $35,000 pension from that moment on. You might be 38 years old, but you're going to be getting it from that moment on for the rest of your life, plus annual increases. You're also going to have health care that basically is comprehensive. It's everything. And you're going to have that. I think the current figure I saw for the cost of the guy who's covered is $400 a year. So you have full health care benefits for $400 a year for the rest of your life. So, you know, these don't even compare to the private sector. The private sector, you know, you might have a 401k.
The 400, you're saying that's the premium they have to pay to be in on that deal.
Yeah, that's exactly what the beneficiary has to pay. So the government is picking up the tab for the rest of it, which is huge. We're talking about down the road, you know, multiple trillion dollar bills, by the time all of the people that have gone through the system since 9/11 are out at the other end. And so it's the expense is huge. And you have to say, well, okay, what justifies this? Well, soldiers can get killed. But the fact is, most of the military, the jobs are not combat jobs. These guys never get into combat. They talk in the military in terms of tooth to tail ratios. A tooth to tail ratio means the guys who are in combat jobs are supported by the tail, which is the people who are not in combat jobs. It basically is 1-3, except it's not even that good, because a lot of combat units have their own support structures that are countered into the combat. So what I'm saying is, you know, very few people in the military actually fight or are in danger, and yet the whole military gets this huge benefit package whereby people can retire at age 37, 38 with lots of benefits, lots of money that goes on forever.
That's amazing. And now when you say a $70,000 salary, what rank is that?
That would be kind of a senior level sergeant, which is where you would be at if you were if you were in for 20 years.
And then, so what does a general make, or what is like?
Oh, these recent generals that have just retired that have been some scandals about were making in excess of $200,000 as a pension.
Wow! So they were making
$200,000.
They were making almost $500,000 a year while they were on the job.
Yeah. And also bear in mind that when you're in the military, you get your housing paid for, you get food allowance, you get a whole lot of other things that people in the private sector don't get. So calculate that in, too. That doesn't even figure into the numbers.
Yeah. Well, this is what David Stockman means about the great deformation, where so much of the economy is so distorted. I mean, think of everyone in the Army, all their wives, all the towns grown up around the Army, if we just had a simple, peaceful, commercial, constitutional republic-type foreign policy. Think of what a massive change it would be. It would be for the better. I mean, all this money mostly is just being wasted, of course. But, you know, like the town of Killeen that is supported by Fort Hood would just, it would be nothing but a place to stop and get a taco on the way to Waco, on the way to Dallas, if it wasn't for Fort Hood. You know what I mean? So that's just one tiny little example. When you talk about all these benefits and all this stuff, it's just, it's almost unimaginable what the economy would look like, what America would look like without this massive, basically, welfare program, basically price support program for those who are not economically viable in our current system, right?
Yeah. And basically, in this article, I look mostly at the soldiers themselves. But, I mean, the fact is, you know, you could expand this discussion sideways, up and down, you know, because we have $5 billion aircraft carriers under construction all the time that are easily attackable by ground-based missiles that don't cost anything.
Yeah, what a great place to pick this conversation up on the other side. The do-nothing floating fortress straight out of 1984. We'll be right back with Phil Trolley in just a second. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. On the phone with Phil Giraldi. Hey, Phil, I just realized I didn't really introduce you very well. Phil Giraldi, he's a former CIA counterterrorism officer, and he also writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com, UNZ, UNZ.com.
And so, yeah, where we were leaving off, you were talking about all the new super carriers being built. You could have said submarines, too. And that reminds me, it's straight out of 1984, which I hope everybody's really read and not just own a copy of. The part where O'Brien the Torturer gives him Goldstein's book on how it really works and all that. And he says, yeah, the purpose for the floating fortress and all the rocket ships is just to take all your money, all your excess productivity, and sink it into the ocean or blast it off into space where you can't get a hold of it. That you might use that money bettering yourself somehow, and that's not in the interest of the party. And so that's why, that was the purpose of the floating fortress, was to keep people impoverished and desperate and in a state of emergency where they're more easy to manipulate, and kind of shades of 2015 right now, if you ask me. But then, of course, there's the giant checks for those who manufacture the floating fortresses, so that's something, too.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of truth to that. The fact is, this machine, this defense machine. I hate to call it defense. I mean, it's not even defense anymore, is it? I mean, it's something else.
It's the empire.
But it's kind of a welfare state for the imperial procurators. The thing is, these aircraft carriers, the Navy has conducted test after test demonstrating that they're highly vulnerable to cheap missiles, which everybody in the world has. These things are basically leviathans that are quite sinkable. And yet we keep producing them. I can understand having a couple of them on hand if you want to get, you know, planes to some crisis point in the world or something like that and have a base for them to fly off of. But do we need 15 of them? But that's one example, certainly. And the other one is, of course, the Air Force with the F-35, which is going to cost $1 trillion by the time it's all over. And the thing apparently doesn't work.
Right. And, you know, they're saying in the chat room, too, isn't it funny, all this money spent on all these pensions and all this health care for the soldiers, breaking the bank for the entire country, and they're still treated like crap. They kill themselves at a rate of 22 a day, and if they need an appointment, they oftentimes can't get one, and then the VA will lie about who even asked for an appointment or whether they got one or not, rather than find a way to get them an appointment with somebody. Here's a voucher. Go get an appointment with somebody since we can't help you. No, they just bury them and pretend they never happened kind of thing. And as one guy in the chat room was saying, well, once you're a veteran, you're no longer of any use to them anyway. So they already, you know, it's like driving a new car off the lot. It lost half its value right there. And then probably if they really did mean well, it's kind of a socialist government bureaucracy type of an enterprise, which by definition kind of can't succeed just because of the economics of the thing. They try to ration services out, and they always fail because they have to fail.
Right, right. It's designed to fail, and they've created a government monster that doesn't work very well, and it doesn't really answer the questions. The problem is a lot of one of the studies I cited in my article is from a Harvard Kennedy School says there are as of 2013 there were 860,000 veterans of the Afghan and Iraq conflict who either were wounded or they were injured or they suffered from the burn pits, from the PTSD. These are people that are going to need either intensively or intermittently medical care for the rest of their lives at a cost of $2 million per person if this care is given. And, you know, it's like, who was thinking when they did all these things, when they got involved in these wars? And is there anyone thinking in Washington right now when they're talking about going to war over Ukraine? It's just like there's a disconnect. And I'm convinced the big problem is that the people who make these decisions are totally immune from the consequences of their decisions. They don't have kids in the military service. They don't suffer when Obamacare comes in. They don't ever have any pain from the bad decisions that they make. So they just go right on and keep making the same decisions.
Yeah. It's like, who's the biggest man in the think tank hallway? Who can come up with the toughest thing to say about what someone else should do?
Well, the biggest man is clearly Robert Kagan.
Yeah, him and his brother, Fat Neck Fred. Two toughest guys
Fred
in town.
Fred is bigger,
sure.
Yeah. Fred might be bigger.
Yeah. Boy, and to plagiarize George Carlin, did you see his wife? Where'd he find her? At a Halloween party or something?
over there for the Institute of Study of the Study of War and how we might get into it. And by the way, I want to ask you about this. I got another Ukraine interview. We could certainly talk about that, but I got one of those coming up. But I want to ask you about Iraq and Syria, as long as we talk about wasting money doing everything wrong and horrible around here. I have a quote here from the Kagans, from the Institute for the Study of War, that they put out last summer about what's got to be done in Iraq and Syria now. And of course, they're staking out the hawkish position. You remember, this is the one where they called for 25,000 troops there. We may have even talked about at the time that in the summary of their report, right at the beginning of their report, the Kagans themselves say it is impossible to articulate a clear path to the desired end state. In other words, we have no reason to believe that what we are proposing here will, quote unquote, work for getting what it is we think we might want, but do it anyway. 25,000 troops, no less.
I'd be afraid to know what they mean by end state.
Yeah, exactly. The desired end state. I don't think I want to know. Well, maybe I do.
Incredible.
Well, so now, so what do you think of this? How much, obviously, somebody, no matter how much concrete for brains these people have up there, they've seen the folly of sending in the 3rd Infantry Division the way Bush Jr. built up in Kuwait and did this massive invasion. But then again, there are leaks all the time where they say it's going to take American soldiers to take Mosul. Do you think that's right? Do you think they're going to go that far this year or at all or what?
Well, my feelings are that essentially that Obama is not willing to go down that road. I think he constantly keeps saying it's an option, but I think the fact that he says it's an option means he's not interested in doing that. So I give him full points for that. But nevertheless, I mean, there's going to be heavy pressure coming from Congress, where McCain is, now head of the Senate Armed Services Committee and so on and so forth. This is going to be incessant. There's going to be incessant pressure for U.S. boots on the ground in the Middle East, and I think you're going to see more pressure for a U.S. presence of some kind, as trainers, new people providing lethal weapons to the Ukrainians. And I think these both of these developments are extremely dangerous. The Russian development is particularly dangerous, and I don't really understand how these people can go to sleep at night when they're pushing this kind of stuff, which is only going to be catastrophic for the American people and catastrophic for everybody else that we come in contact with.
Yeah, well, on piles and piles of money. You think Army pensions for enlisted men are good? What do you think these guys make when they got their Center for a New American Security salary coming in? In fact, I bet you know the answer to that.
Yeah, they have salaries usually in the $200,000 to $300,000 range, and of course then they have perks on top of that in terms of traveling first class and staying at the expensive hotels and hobnobbing with the Kagans and things like that.
Yeah. Well, and actually that does raise the question though. I guess a lot of them are at least part-time professors or something. They've got to get their pensions from somewhere. Do the think tanks give them pensions, like AEI and the Council on Foreign Relations?
Sure.
And stuff?
Sure, they have 401ks that they contribute to, and they're very generous. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. They're always thinking of their bottom line. No question about it.
Yeah, I really am lucky that I had a high school history teacher that explained that, yeah, ever since World War II, it's a wartime economy, basically. They never did ramp that down and change it back into just normal times, and never even mind, her socialist ideal or whatever. But just, you got to understand that for the way the system is now, they got to keep making bombs and dropping them on people under some excuse or another, and be prepared to see that the rest of your life. And
that's where we are
right now. They got to do something, huh?
Yeah, there's some truth to that, and it's gotten worse since obviously your time in high school. Because the fact is that the defense contractors have been clever enough to put their plants, all over the place. They're in every constituency in the United States. So it always comes down to an issue, an alleged issue for congressmen to say, oh, well, we have jobs in our district.
Yeah. It sure does look now like it's going to keep rolling on like this until the nukes go off or the dollar breaks, or I guess if the first happens, the second will too, and maybe vice versa. But otherwise, I don't know. But keep up the good fight and keep writing your great stuff, Phil. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's the great Phil Giralt. He's at uns.com in the American Conservative magazine. We'll be right back.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I was just about to talk about that, Fitzy G. Fitzy G's in the chat room. He says, oh, by the way, James Carden on the Ukraine catastrophe coming up in a few. Fitzy G's saying, hey, man, you're wrong, though, that it's not important. It is important. It's hilariously important. It's important because of its hilarity. As Fitzy puts it, apparently Brian Williams is a regular Chris Kyle and made up all kinds of tall tales, including having a Christmas tree stolen from him, seeing a guy kill himself at the Superdome by jumping off of the fourth floor or whatever, seeing a body float by in the French Quarter, which wasn't even flooded. Supposedly, I think this is right. Where'd I get this from? Was this from The Daily Show? Yeah, but it was a clip of another news story saying that he actually had claimed to save puppies in a fire. Is that really right? Brian Williams. I'm sorry to everyone whose heart is broken. to come to find out, you know, there was a thing going around on Twitter yesterday about they have the pollsters actually have a confidence index of some type of who do you trust the most. And he really was at the very top of that list. Right up there in the, you know, low double digits, I think. I'm sorry, I don't remember. But now he's down to 800 and something, down next to Harvey Keitel or something like that. Anyway, so he's, boy, is his credibility just blown out of the water, which is beautiful. But what do you mean? He was trustworthy? The American people? You know, I don't know. I guess I grew up, my dad always liked Brokaw the best. So we would watch Rather and Jennings too, because commercials come on at different times, although they would try to time it where their commercials come on at the same time. But those were your only choices back then, you know. And, you know, I learned real quick that, you know, I would see, for example, Rather would do a story one night. And then the next night, Brokaw would do a story where he got something wrong that, on the face of it, it's pretty clear that Rather got it right yesterday and Brokaw missed it just now. And so I expected to see Rather hold Brokaw to account or see Brokaw correct himself. Actually, guys, I screwed up yesterday when I forgot to mention this salient point that Rather had reported. No correction ever came from NBC or from the competition. Oh, I get it. These guys can screw up all the time and there's no accountability. I really am lucky, this life I've lived. I just come upon these insights at just such a young age. I must have been, you know, I don't know, very young. Elementary school, third or fourth grade or something, the first time I started noticing this kind of thing. That's what I'm thinking. Just incidentally, luck of the draw. But I guess you're supposed to be impressed that Brokaw and Williams, that, hey, if these guys have been news guys for a long time, then they must really know what they're talking about. They certainly know a lot more about it than I do. So if they're telling me that something is true, I guess, I don't know. And then, so the only time you're supposed to, or I guess the only time people mostly, you know, figure out that that's not true is when they see journalism about something that they personally know about. And they go, yeah, but you entirely missed the point, or you basically lied by omission here, here, and here, or whatever. You ever been in the newspaper? Did the reporter get you right? They never get it right. They can't. There's somebody else, and there's space constrictions, and even the technology of writing kind of necessitates some things are included and others not, and, you know? So, I don't know. People are heartbroken. Across America, people can't believe that now they can't believe Brian Williams. I'm sorry I went on so long about that, because what I really wanted to talk about, of course, is how they all lie all day and actually know probably if you have an interest in anything, like, say, foreign policy, even if you've just been interested for a little while, you probably know a lot of things that these media people don't know. Or you can tell that they're lying about things that they must know but are still telling you something else. All you got to know is just enough to see how it is. You know, there's obviously an unlimited amount to be learned. But if you can, you know, just study up some different books and some different sources for a long enough amount of time, you sort of, by osmosis, you sort of get the hang of a thing or two, you will see discrepancies. In fact, you could have principle of any kind. You could be a real conservative or a real liberal or a socialist or leftist or libertarian or any kind of thing where you really actually believe something, and immediately you'll start noticing a lot of discrepancies in other people's stuff, especially people with power, you know? Even if you got it wrong compared to me, you'll still notice a lot of the same things I notice about what they're getting wrong, what they're saying wrong. And the point is that really the more powerful a media figure you are, the less you know. The deeper embedded you are in the military, the less you know about what's really going on in the big picture that makes what you're doing with the military actually not make any sense at all, instead of being the mission of mercy and heroism that you portray it as. And so, and also you spend so much time in the makeup chair and traveling around and being a star that you don't have time to sit around and read antiwar.com all day, which is how people actually learn things in this world. And so, people like Brian Williams, they got a lot of gaps that they have to fill with a bunch of crap. And when they're repeating lies that they're reading right off the teleprompter, most of the time they don't even know. Hey, everybody knows we got to attack the Baathist government in Syria. You know, Jake Tapper, he's one who, he's better read than some of these guys. He's an actual journalist, not just an anchor, right? He, like, went and did a whole tour of duty and book over there in Afghanistan as a journalist. He knows some things. But you think about his frame during the, really this whole time, about who America ought to be back in Syria. Of course, everybody knows in the consensus that the rebels, who include the Al-Nusra Front, and since midway through 2013, the Islamic State, which is the same damn thing, just broke off under different leadership, that in that war, Assad is the bad guy and the one we're supposed to be attacking. And I remember thinking, you know, Tapper's intellectually honest enough, I want to send him a tweet. I remember at the end of, he's the CNN guy, by the way, if you're not familiar. At the end of summer, you know, late August, early September 2013, they're trying to get us into war with Syria over the so-called chemical weapons thing, which turns out most likely was a Turkish al-Nusra false flag attack to get America to launch a war against the Assad regime, according to the great journalist Seymour Hersh and others. But anyway, during that time, I remember he was saying on TV and tweeting out, what must the government do? What must the administration do to convince the American people this must be done? I mean, really? Come on, man. So I tweeted him and said, seriously? Hey, man, why not for 1 minute? What must the American people do to convince the president that they don't want him to do this? That's inconceivable to Jake Tapper, and he's one of the smarter of these guys. But he can only see it their way. In effect, he's a stupid ass. Because he can only see it from the point of view of the state. How do we get these people to support our elite, really foreign-based agenda? Because Israel and Turkey and Saudi are obsessed with Assad. Americans should have a war and die. That's the unchallenged, unspoken, but just absolutely 100% true premise and, you know, presumption behind the entire argument. And there's a million of them. Should we or should we not arm the Ukrainians against Russian aggression? Well, what if there is no Russian aggression at all? Then what? What if someone wants to dispute the narrative about whether the Russians are aggressing in Ukraine at all? How the hell are separatists, by definition, how are they aggressors?
And then when someone is attacking them and someone is arming them, how is that aggression? When all the Russians are accused of doing, I mean, they keep retracting all their claims of the thousands of Russian soldiers, the make-believe ones. All they're accused of doing is providing some weapons, the exact thing, same thing America's doing all over the world. That's aggression? Yep, TV says.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so, yeah, in the chat room, Fitzy G and over at FFF.org, Sheldon Richman, both, you know, extrapolating on to, man, about Ebola and, of course, Iran's nuclear program. Sheldon writes all about that. Oh, we're supposed to be afraid. How many times have you heard Iran's nuclear weapons program and what must be done about it? A million times. And then, of course, they never had one. They never had one. They never had one. Oh, my God. Whatever will become of us when Iran is done completing their nuclear weapons that they're making with their nuclear weapons program? We never had to worry about it. It never was true. But now, so here's the thing. I want to be a little more specific for a second here, if I can. Actually, three cop stories real quick, because I won't have time to get to them. Family asks cops to check in on their 74-year-old veteran grandfather after his surgery. They break into his house and kill him. They kick the door in. He's standing there with a gun. They just wax him. Thanks a lot for doing a welfare check, guys. That's at rawstory.com. This one is at Liberty Crier. Cop with history of inattentive driving runs over a 100-year-old woman. It was a parallel parking zone, not a diagonal parking zone, but the cop parked diagonal because cops can do whatever they want. They can murder whoever they want. They can run over 100-year-old ladies if they want and not get in trouble, so they can sure as hell park however they want. And so the 100-year-old lady had to walk around the cop's illegally parked car, and so the cop just backed up without looking at all and ran her over to death. 100-year-old woman. No charges, no accountability. Why? Because she might as well be the Duchess of Yorkshire or some crap. She might as well have the divine right of kings, because she's a lowly deputy sheriff, piece of crap, who has complete immunity, a license to kill the 100-year-old woman's daughter and granddaughter and great-granddaughter and great-great-granddaughter too, if she felt like it. Because that's the law in America. She can kill whoever she wants because she's got a little piece of plastic costume jewelry. And if you disagree with that, then that's how it should be, then you're a crazy, irresponsible libertarian anarchist. Oh, here's one. Mississippi couple asks FBI for help. Good luck with that. After the cops point guns at autistic 6-year-old son. Well, listen, here's the thing about that. The headline actually understates it. They pulled their guns on the boy. They were already in the house. They were arresting the 23-year-old brother of the lady who owned the place. And the 6-year-old autistic boy said, "Don't do that. Please don't hurt my uncle." And the cops drew their guns on the 6-year-old. But they can do that because they're cops, and they might as well be Genghis Khan, who rules without question over the subhumans beneath his conquest, or I don't know. Who's got the most impunity in world history? Barack Obama? Every deputy sheriff is Barack Obama. Every deputy sheriff can murder whoever he wants, can draw and pull a gun and point it in the face of a 6-year-old retarded boy. because he's a cop. He can do whatever he wants. He owns you. Your life is worth one millionth his life, so just get on the floor and lick it and beg and thank the state for allowing you to exist. And be happy with that, because you're an American. Okay, now back to the media war lies there about Iraq. See, they lied about the motive for the war. It was not about preventing Saddam from giving weapons of mass destruction to terrorists like Osama bin Laden who might use them against us. Because, see, they knew he didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. They knew they were lying about that, every bit of it. And they knew that Saddam wasn't buds with Osama. They knew that too. And they had the highest level sources in both cases who absolutely debunked all of that stuff, including the head of the bin Laden division of the CIA, who reported that, no, there is nothing to sustain the accusation Saddam is friends with Osama in any way. Never even mind the story of the meeting with Iraqi intelligence and Mohammed Atta in Prague, which never happened, and which was debunked in real time, you know, at the time by the FBI and the CIA. Anyway. They knew Saddam didn't have the weapons. They'd known for a fact 100% since 1995, and they knew that nothing had changed, and so they lied about why. The real reason they wanted to do it is because Junior wanted to prove that he was a bigger, tougher guy than his dad. Karl Rove wanted to make sure he was reelected in 2004. Dick Cheney wanted to pay off Halliburton because he had lost them a bunch of money being a really crappy CEO during the 1990s, and want to make sure they could get direct access to the U.S. Treasury, to the money that comes out of your check is their welfare payment, you understand? And also, I think he's a true believer in what you could call fascism, and means to have global hegemony, benevolent or otherwise, and he was accompanied by a bunch of Israel firsters. Some of them outright traitors, some of them just so Likudnik they don't need to be outright traitors, but they were what was known by Colin Powell, who was the Secretary of State himself and who lied us into war at the UN. He called them Douglas Feith's Gestapo office, the separate government that Dick Cheney created inside the government with specially handpicked neoconservatives placed in the State Department, especially the Defense Department, and of course the Vice President's office, to coordinate the entire campaign to lie us into war. And with Karl Rove chairing what was called the White House Iraq Group, coming up with the final spin on all the talking points to disseminate to all the media. John Stewart played a very prominent and important clip of that on his show last night, where they were talking about the aluminum tubes, which you were supposed to believe amount to a nuclear weapons program, when, of course, they were not even ever for centrifuges in the first place. Never even mind what you got to do with a centrifuge to get a nuclear bomb. But anyway, they were just for rockets. They were from the Italians, our allies. They weren't selling nuclear centrifuges to Saddam. It was a big lie. Anyway, they also lied about Saddam's attempt to buy uranium from Africa. They lied every bit about all of his connections to al-Qaeda, and that was specifically Michael Maloof and I guess Feith and one other person whose name is escaping me, and something that was called the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group, which was basically a separate little office of special plans that was just for coming up with Iraq al-Qaeda lies. And they even at one point had an opportunity to brief George Bush on the supposed connection between Iraq and actually the September 11th attack, not just al-Qaeda, but September 11th itself. And then you had the entire project inside the Office of Special Plans coming up with all the talking points about all the WMD, the VX, the sarin, the anthrax, all the German chemical weapons, lying about it the whole time. And I'm out of time. I can't tell you all my damn footnotes, but stop by my blog later. I'll leave a bunch of links there for you. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin.
Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is James Carden. He's at the National Interest. That's nationalinterest.org. And one of the handful who's good on Ukraine issues these days. And it is a pretty small handful of writers who are getting this right. But like James, pretty much all of them are really good on it, the ones who are good at all. So at least we can be thankful for that. And I think, James, you're saying in this article that things are looking a little bit brighter along those lines, that there's been some pretty positive backlash against the Brookings report recommending arming the Ukrainians. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me back. I mean, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, what a difference a week makes. In late, you know, the last week in January, we were seeing a very coordinated campaign by the part of a lot of think tanks and op-ed columnists urging the Obama administration to arm Kyiv. And it began around January 27th with a piece by Ivo Dobler, who's the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and it continued on until February 2nd when Brookings, Chicago Council, and Brookings, Chicago Council, and the Atlanta Council released this report. A so-called fact-finding report urging the president to go ahead and send so-called defensive weapons to Kyiv. And the pushback from that was immediate and, to some of us, quite gratifying. And you saw very, very esteemed Russia hands from all over, from the Kennan Institute, from Brookings, from the Carnegie Endowment, all saying that this is quite a terrible idea. They were joined by, you know, people who have been saying this all along, like John Mearsheimer and Stephen Cohen. And so it seems like the tide might be turning, and the president hopefully will not follow through on such a foolish, dangerous, reckless policy.
Yeah, well, that certainly is good news. And, well, first of all, let's rewind one step. Is it significant that it's the Brookings Institution, the Atlantic Council, and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which I guess by the sound of them seem like kind of older, more centrist type establishments as compared to, you know, the usual suspects, AEI and you know, whoever's doing what Crystal wants, you know, in the neoconservative movement. It wasn't the, you know, Fred Kagan's wife, it was, well, Robert Kagan's wife got us into this mess, but Fred Kagan's wife, she's not, you know, from the Institute for the Study of War. She's not a co-signatory on here. So is this really, before the pushback you describe, is this more a matter of consensus, or it really is more just kind of a neocon weirdo position to take that they should do this?
No, I think that's what was so worrying about the Chicago Council, Atlantic Council, and Brookings report, because these people are really members of the establishment. I mean, Stroh Talbot was Deputy Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. He is a leading candidate to be Secretary of State if Hillary Clinton should become president, God help us. And Michelle Flournoy is a leading candidate to be Hillary Clinton's Secretary of Defense. These people are former ambassadors, former representatives to NATO, former generals and admirals. So no, what was so worrying was that these folks were are establishment people, and they were basically mimicking the crystal neoconservative talking points. And so I think some of us are breathing a sigh of relief that other establishment hands got in on the debate and pushed back against this idea.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. You know, I first heard of Strobe Talbott years ago because he'd written a thing in Time magazine called The Birth of the Global Nation in 1992. The summer of 92, saying, well, very soon we'll have a one-world government where the U.S. and Russia and the European Union and everybody obeys a single authority under a one-world federal army. And boy, I guess if we're going to ask him to predict the future of you know, whatever policies, you know, maybe we ought to think twice about, you know, his insight as it's been proven out so far.
Well, Talbott is a very curious case. Throughout the 80s, when he was writing for Time, he was someone who was seen as a dove. He was very critical of Reagan's sort of hardline Cold War policy. And then when he got into the government during the 90s in the Clinton administration, he underwent this incredible transformation into the uber hawk that he is today. And it's quite... It's quite puzzling that he seems to view Mr. Putin's Russia as a greater danger than the old Soviet Union.
Right. And one thing here real quick, just on the politics still, before we actually get to what's important here, is the war and the crisis itself. But Michelle Flournoy, it's brought up in the chat room how she didn't want to be nominated by Obama to be Secretary of Defense because, as she put it, she wanted to wait for Hillary Clinton. And that's just, it's kind of frustrating to me to see where this woman, I guess it just doesn't count. Does it count in Washington, D.C.? Does anyone mention how she lost the Afghan war? She's the lady who was the leading champion of the counterinsurgency doctrine, which supposedly worked in Iraq and so needed to be replicated in Afghanistan by tripling the war there and extending its length. And it didn't work. She was in Feith's job, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And, I mean, all indications are she was in charge of policy to a great degree and what was going on over there. And is it not even a mark against her that this lady lost a war? Or does Afghanistan not count as a loss yet, or what?
Well, I once wrote an article in The Nation where I said that living in Obama's Washington is like living in a town almost wholly inhabited by amnesiacs. So, no, it's not going to count against her. You know, none of these folks who were in power and whose advice led to such disasters under President George W. Bush have paid any sort of professional price at all. You know, it's really true what Stephen Walt said, that being a neocon means never having to say you're sorry.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I'm far from expecting real accountability or anything, but it seems like there would be the slightest bit of shame and embarrassment and recall. But no, I guess I'm being silly. I'm sorry. I don't mean to waste your interview on silly topics like accountability.
It's nice to dream.
Yeah, it is sometimes. All right. Well, now, so we're almost up near the break here, but I guess, well, let me ask you this when it comes to failing. It seems like the underlying narrative in the report and all the op-eds around it is that, hey, we're going to push the Russians. Obviously, we can't beat them and we can't help the Ukrainians beat them, but we can make the war cost a lot to the Russians. And but they don't, it's like they don't finish the sentence. And make them matter is the rest of the sentence. But it, they just sort of seem, but it can't be right that they just don't think of the end of the sentence of what they expect to happen as a result of this arming. But they just sort of leave the argument at that. Let's just arm them and we'll worry about what happens to Baghdad later kind of attitude,
right?
You know?
Right. It's almost as though they think it's a consequence-free policy. I happen to think that, you know, the way that at least that Brookings report outlined it, it happens to also be a deeply immoral policy, because what they want to do is send, and they basically said this in the report, is to send more people back to Moscow in body bags. So the war will become unpopular and Putin will be forced to turn around. But, of course, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Hey, they're being pretty honest to put it that way. I'm sorry. I got to stop you, but we got to go out to this break, James. But we'll be right back, everybody. It's James Carden from the National Interest. The article is, Here's Why Arming Ukraine Would Be a Disaster. Very important piece. Go find it there. Nationalinterest.org. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with James Carden from nationalinterest.org. The National Interest, also he writes for the American Conservative Magazine. And we're talking about the crisis in Ukraine, the politics about it in D.C., and I guess we need to get into the global ones a bit here, too. I'm sorry, at the break here, James, when I had to interrupt you, you were talking about the stated purpose, according to the Brookings Institute thing. They're coming right out and saying what we want is more dead Russians because we hope that'll change the political conversation in Moscow.
Yes. So that's just one piece that makes the report, just one of the many pieces that is utterly unrealistic about the report. It is this theory that we can send in these so-called defensive weapons and make the cost unbearable to Mr. Putin strikes me as a very, very unrealistic and very, very dangerous idea.
And now, back to the good news again about how a lot of people are saying, hey, come on now, this is just, even on NPR, they ask him, well, what if he calls our bluff? They said, I don't know. Ivo Dodler, who you mentioned, the lead author of the thing, said, well, geez, I guess if they call our bluff and escalate further, then, well, we'll escalate further, and that'll lead to even more dead Russians, and then that'll lead the debate to change in Moscow, maybe. And yeah, so that was all I could say. It was same thing again.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just go ahead. I was repeating myself.
Not at all. Well, the other piece that goes unmentioned is that, Let's say that we send in these weapons and the Russians escalate and then we escalate. So that's sort of those sort of cancel each other out. But that means that there are more armaments in the war zone, which will mean that there will be more civilian casualties. And the authors of the report and the people who are cheering this policy on never really mention the fact that, already there are 5,400 casualties, and that number will certainly take a lot higher if we pursue arming Kyiv. They don't seem to mention that, and it doesn't seem to register because you need to think about who the people are who are dying. They're Eastern Ukrainians, meaning that they're pro-Russian, they're Russian-speaking, and so they don't really count in their worldview, right? These people are solely concerned with their clients in Kyiv. And in the west of the country, and they don't really seem to register. These people are treated as sort of, collateral damage. And they seem perfectly fine with that. And I think that that's a huge problem.
And now, so here's the thing, too. I was reading Stephen Walt over there at Foreign Policy, and he was talking about these different models of intervention and when to deter and when to appease and this kind of thing. And he was saying that because we're kind of in this on the false premise that Russian aggression, so we must deter it. We're mistaking that what Russia's doing is a reaction because of how insecure they feel. And so when we escalate our deterrence based on the false narrative of what's really going on here, we actually make them, it's sort of an equation that guarantees further escalation on their part. When what we should be doing is the obvious thing is saying, hey, trying to demand that you have to have either a trade deal with us or a trade deal with them, and using a bunch of Nazis to overthrow the government and all that, that's a little bit out of line. Let's go with Austria during the Cold War, you know, Finland sort of neutrality model, and you can have trade with whoever you want and kind of back off. That's the obvious thing to do if you understand what really happened here. But if everybody's agreed upon the lie that this whole crisis started when Putin invaded Crimea in the spring of last year, for crying out loud, which seems to be what everybody in the media thinks, and all the people they, all the so-called experts they interview, then it seems like even if they mean well, they really think, as Newsweek puts it, oh my God, it's a new domino theory. That's their new article at Newsweek, is that if we don't deter Putin now, the Baltics are next.
Yeah, that's one of the sillier arguments I've heard. And people who are supporting this new domino theory also seem to have a very short memory. The domino theory is what got us into quite a great deal of trouble in Vietnam. And then the democratic domino theory, which was used to justify the Iraq War and subsequent interventions in the Middle East, have also not ended so well. So the fact that these folks are actually calling it a domino theory raises some very serious questions about what they know and what they do not know about recent American history. With regard to dating the conflict to March, that's another kind of sleight of hand trick that these people do. The conflict didn't begin in March with Putin's annexation of Crimea and then subsequent invasion later on in April. It began in February. It could be said, actually, that it began in November when Yanukovych was being pressured by the European Union to sign the EU Association Agreement. So that's exactly right. When you begin with a lousy premise, you're not going to come up with a proper solution to the problem.
Well, we have a kind of weird incentive problem here, right? Where people don't want to admit they're wrong, but boy, for them to continue wanting to base a policy, on the false premise, we can see, you know, just how wrong they get it, right? They've been corrected now by Henry Kissinger, and then as you're reporting here, now for a second time, Kissinger, at least by proxy, his organization has put out another thing on this. They've been corrected by John Mearsheimer in Foreign Affairs and some other prominent places about, hey, everybody, hold your horses, what's going on here? But they still seem to be proceeding ahead based on, as you put it in here, the McCain view of the world of what's going on here. And never mind his role in Ukraine leading up to the coup of last February.
That's right. He and Chris Murphy went over to address the protests on the Maidan I believe it was in December. That's sort of an extraordinary thing. You know, we had Victoria Nuland handing out cookies to the protesters. Now imagine if a Russian official went up to Occupy Wall Street and handed out cookies. What would our reaction be to something like that, getting involved in our domestic politics? I don't know why we think we have the right or the wisdom to interfere in countries' internal affairs, countries that are 4,000 or 5,000 miles from our shores. It doesn't make any sense. And then when we do get involved, the results are nothing less than disastrous.
Yeah. And now, well, so is there a way to kind of make it okay for them to admit that, all right, well, we've gone off a little half-cocked here and let's scale it back? I mean, it seems like Obama's a bit reluctant to continue to push forward. And obviously McCain's not going to be quiet. But do you think when the Kennan Group and Kissinger Associates and these guys start pushing back, is that going to have some kind of effect, you think?
I hope so. I hope it has had some effect on the president's decision-making. I think the most influential person in terms of influencing Obama is Angela Merkel. And she stated at the Munich Security Conference over the weekend that arming Ukraine is not a good idea, that there's no military solution to the crisis, and that it could only be solved at the negotiating table. And she's exactly right. And she is one of the few people outside of his inner circle, his very, very small insular inner circle, that actually can get through to him. So I think as long as she stands firm, we won't follow the recommendations of this daft report. Mm.
Yeah, I guess if you're the leader of Germany, it's a little harder to see these kinds of things in these sort of abstract think tank sort of terms. It's they have a little bit better historical memory of what a crisis like this could amount to if it really came down to it over there, huh?
Well, and not only that, it's right in their neighborhood. I mean, you know, think about that. I mean, that influences your way of thinking too. And that's something that people here, especially the neoconservatives, don't particularly understand. What if Russia was trying to set up naval bases in Mexico and in Canada? What would our reaction be? What was our reaction during the Cuban Missile Crisis? The fact that Ukraine is on that border, Kyiv is 400 miles from Moscow, that seems to make no impression on these bloodthirsty neoconservatives.
Yep. All right. Well, I sure appreciate the fact that you keep writing about this. It's very important. And I'm not sure how much traffic nationalinterest.org gets, but I bet it's pretty important traffic when it comes down to that. And what you're doing, I think, is really making a difference in the narrative here. So please continue.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time again on the show, James. All right, y'all. That's James Carden. He is at nationalinterest.org and also at the American Conservative magazine. That's theamericanconservative.com. And see y'all tomorrow.